Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, and welcome to Indie Streak. My name is Rachel Galvin, and as you know, I interview film industry professionals on this show. If you've missed any of the shows, you can go back and listen to the archive. Well, today, I'm interviewing actress and author Harley Jane Kozak, and I believe I have her on the line. Let me just see here. Harley, are you there?
I'm here. How are you, Rachel?
Hi. Good. How are you?
I'm good.
I'm glad this finally worked out for you to come on the show.
Oh, me too. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Well, before we get into talking about your books, I want to talk a little bit about your acting career and how you got your start. Did you always want to be an actress?
Yeah, from about the time that I was maybe 12 or 13 years old, I knew that that's what I wanted to do. And I started focusing on it pretty single-mindedly. And I did a lot of, all the plays in middle school and high school, and then I went to the School of the Arts at NYU, which is a professional training school, and that was like a really serious classical avant-garde bohemian education, and then I went from there to the soaps for 5 years, which was kind of the polar opposite extreme of acting, and from the soaps I went to nighttime TV and feature films, and That's pretty much it. So that covered about probably 20 or 25 years.
Mm-hmm. And what was it like? I know you grew up, you were in Pennsylvania, then you were in Nebraska, and you were in North Dakota, and all these other smaller locales, and then to go to someplace like New York and L.A., what was that transition like for you?
Well, the transition from Nebraska, Lincoln, Nebraska, to New York was pretty extreme. But you know what? I was really focused on it. And even in Nebraska, I would go to see movies like Taxi Driver, for instance, and I would try to prepare myself mentally for the fact that it was going to be scary and crime-ridden and awful. And, of course, it was none of those things for me.
I know.
It was great.
Crazy, isn't it?
You know, my theory is that people either love New York or they can't imagine why anybody would live there. And
I love it.
Happily, I was in the former camp, and I was very happy there for about 9 years. And I don't know if I would have gotten to L.A. had I not gotten my third soap, which was Santa Barbara, that brought me to L.A. in 1985. And I never expected to stay here, but then I kept getting work, and then one day I went back to New York, moved my stuff out of storage, and realized I guess I live in L.A. now. So here I am.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm a huge fan of Guiding Light. I used to watch it when I was really small. I was watching it. So I was watching you, and when I was like, oh, my gosh, I know you. When I saw that you were at Guiding Light, I thought, oh, my gosh, that's wonderful. How did you get that first soap opera role? Was it to your agent? Did you know someone?
My first soap opera role was on a soap called Texas. And that I think Texas ran just a couple of years. And, yeah, I got that through my agent. And that was canceled after I'd been on it for about a year and a half, through no fault of mine, I hope. But the executive producer of Texas, a woman named Gail Kobe, went on to produce Guiding Light, and she took took several people with her, among them the head writer and me. And so the head writer already had worked with me, a really wonderful woman named Pamela Longhammer, who had been an actress and then turned into a writer, which was probably maybe where I got the idea too. But anyway, so Gail and Pam wrote my character, which was kind of wonderful, Annabelle Sims Reardon, which you may remember, Rachel, but she had a great entrance. She was this mystery woman for a long time, and I had some great storylines, and so I was very happy doing that for 2 years. And then I thought, okay, this is it. I'm going to make my break. I'm going to see what else is out there beyond soaps. But then I got the offer just as my contract was coming to an end on Guiding Light, and I was determined to move on. I got the offer for Santa Barbara, and I thought, okay, I've only been to California a couple of times, and they were with Guiding Light. So I thought, this is a chance to live in L.A. for a little bit and see what that's all about. So I said yes to Santa Barbara, and that's that was a big transition moment for me, getting me from the East Coast to the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. Explain for those out there that don't know what it's like, what the difference is between working on a soap opera versus a film or TV, because it is different. So talk a little bit about the filming process.
Okay, soaps. So first of all, I have to say that this was back in the day when I was doing them, which was in the mid-80s. So the whole landscape has changed along with the rest of the world, but so it's not quite the same now. But back then, which was kind of the heyday of the soap operas, we filmed, at least the three ones that I did, we filmed an episode every day. So that was 5 days a week, sometimes 6 days a week. I worked a lot on Saturdays. And you go through a 60-page script and get it on to film every single day, or get it on to tape.
Yeah.
And by comparison, a feature film usually gets maybe two and three quarters pages filmed every day. I mean, they literally break it down to an eighth of a page that they're going to get done this afternoon. And that is like glacier speed compared to soaps. And so it's a luxury to do a feature film coming from soaps, which is, I think, the only way to do it, because when we would have some celebrity casting on the soaps and we'd have a day where some wonderful feature film actress was there doing a scene or two, some of them just couldn't hack it because the pace was so fast, and it's really disconcerting. Another key difference is on soaps, you get these long scripts, which sometimes you don't even have a chance to read until the day you're shooting it, whereas in a feature film, you're working on that script for weeks before you show up on the set. In a soap, you get a little bit of rehearsal, usually around 6 or 7 in the morning, and then you're in hair and makeup. You're usually rehearsing with curlers in your hair. And then, boom, you're on the set. And it doesn't matter if you don't get the lines perfectly well. In fact, improvisation is really good training for the soaps. Whereas in feature films, they're a lot more concerned that you do the script as written. And in the theater, of course, you have weeks of rehearsal, and you do the lines exactly as written, on the assumption that the playwright meant you to say those exact words. Whereas on soaps, you have different writers for every day of the week. So there's no continuity among the writers, and you have a lot more control over your character, which is a really interesting concept for a classically trained actor. It really flies in the face of a lot of the rest of the medium.
Mm-hmm. So do you like
And, of course, a lot of the dialogue and the storylines are sloppy and occasionally schlocky, and that takes a real talent to kind of pull that off. But I would say the main qualification for being a soap actor is to be, of course, attractive. As you know, on soaps, they spend a lot of time on hair and makeup and wardrobe, but working fast is really, really the most important attribute of an actor on a soap.
So did you like that experience? I mean, it sounds like you're glad you did it, but do you prefer soaps over film or TV, or do you say it's a luxury to do film?
Oh,
which one do you like?
I think it's the secret desire of most soap actors to get out of the soaps, the soap ghetto, and move on to nighttime TV and feature films. And in part because the soaps, even in their heyday and even today, even though there are rabid fans of them, for the most part, they don't get a lot of respect. And for the most part, the work is so quick. And if you want to do something that is enduring and, more highbrow, I guess, and more respected, then, of course, you want to do feature films and primetime television. So it was a great training ground for me. And a lot of people do it as a lifestyle because it's very conducive to having a family. You're in one place. The hours are, even if the hours are long, at least you can count on them. In the rest of the acting world, that's just not true. In theater, it's true. You know what time the curtain goes up and what time it goes down, and the rehearsals are very structured, but in film and television, it's just crazy. It's crazy, and so is the audition process. So I think most soap actors, when they stay on the soaps forever, it's because they just love that particular niche, or they need the paycheck, and it's the one that you can count on, at least until the last couple of years, and they're comfortable there, or they're very, very rooted in their family. Life is very important to them. But no, I wouldn't say I would never go back to soaps. It wouldn't be my first choice, but if someone came along, offered me a job when I really needed the money, yeah, of course I would do it.
And you won an award. You won the Soap Opera Digest Award. Is there any other awards that I missed that you won?
No, that was my big award, and I think that might have been a sympathy award because my character had just died. And she had a pretty memorable death. I played, at this point, this was on Santa Barbara, I played a nun named Mary, and after a long and checkered series of events, she was crushed to death by a giant neon letter C. And she was pregnant at the time with her lover's baby, so it was particularly poignant. And I think the fans were so distraught over that I think that's why I won that award, to be honest.
Funny. And you've done a lot of great films. You were in Parenthood with Steve Martin.
Yes.
That must have been a blast. Was he really funny on set?
It was a blast. It took me about 2 weeks to get beyond the terror, though, and settle in and really enjoy it. Because I'd done a couple of small parts in films before that, and I had done a big part in a grade B horror movie. But that was my first really big movie. Ron Howard was the director. And after I got the job, my agent told me who else was in the cast, and I started to cry because I was so intimidated. And I said, I'm the only nobody in this movie. And he said, yeah, you kind of are. And so it took me a while to calm down and feel like, okay, this is just acting. I know how to do this. I've been doing this for years. It's going to be okay. And Rick Moranis, who played my husband, really was my best friend on that movie. And Mary Steenburgen and Diane Wiest, and they were very, very they sort of took my hand, and I think they could see how overwhelmed I was, and they were really kind to me. And Rick taught me a lot about the difference between feature films and television, like how to save your emotional reactions for the close up and not waste it on the master shot, which is something very different in the soap. The first take, that's it. So you learn to do it, give it all on the first take. But in film, you can't sustain that. The first take might be a shot and the camera is, 30 yards away, and they don't care if you're crying. So why put yourself through that when you're going you're going to literally run out of tears by the time your close-up comes along. So Rick taught me that essential difference, and which was really crucial to having a career then in film.
I know you were in Arachnophobia. Did they have spiders really on the set? What was that like?
Yes, we did. We had lots of spiders. Oh, they gave the actors spider tutorials. It was a really fun movie. It was produced by Steven Spielberg. And so there was a lot of happy people and a happy and well-paid crew, and everyone had worked together a lot. And it was a really fun movie to make. And Frank Marshall, the director, it was his first film, so he was particularly excited and enthusiastic, and it was just a really lot of fun. We filmed it in this great small town on the coast of California. And some of the spiders were plastic. Some of them were, I think, animatronics, like electronic spiders.
Uh-huh.
But then a number of them were the real deal. And they flew them in from somewhere, I don't know, south of the border, and they were interesting to work with. Spiders, when they get cold. No, I was. I mean, I can't say that I love spiders, but after we worked with the spider wrangler, and like anything else, if you look at it up close and then you start very small and, you let it touch you and then you let it walk on your hand a little bit and then, that kind of childlike science lab curiosity takes over and you think, oh, this is just another of God's creatures here, and there's nothing really intrinsically frightening about it. And you know, they're very useful little things, and they eat bugs. Of course, in our movie, we were meant to terrify. So, but it's a little difficult if the actors are terrified. You want the audience to be terrified, but it's not a lot of fun if the actors are terrified. So, no, it was fine. I've had a lot harder time working with rodents, which I had to do on Guiding Light, one horrible day in my acting life.
What was that
and
like?
Snakes I'm okay with also, which I also worked with on Guiding Light. Mm-hmm. Snakes were fine. The rodents, they're difficult to work with because they tend to like dark corners. So the lights on a set are very bright, of course, and so they need to get the rodent, in our case it was a rat, in the light, and the rat was supposed to be climbing over my face while I was unconscious. So it was particularly gruesome for me because the rat didn't really want to do it because they don't like bright lights. So they would, you know, the rat wrangler would place the rat on my face. He'd walk away, the camera would be on, and the rat would zoom into the darkness. And so we had to do it, it seemed like endless times before they actually got any footage that was useful. So that was a bad afternoon for me.
You've done a lot of iconic films, like you were in When Harry Met Sally. What was that like, being in that set?
That was another potentially intimidating set, except that Billy Crystal is truly funny, and Rob Reiner, who directed it, also really funny, and Meg Ryan was wonderful to me. And I think the day, I only had one day of work on that, although it was, as you say, an iconic moment for me. So although I only had about six lines, they were kind of memorable because of my character's extreme effect on Billy Crystal's character. So I got a lot of buildup for it. And Meg and I think, were the only women on the set that day. So we became, you know, buddies for the day in hair and makeup, and she was really wonderful. And it was a lot of laughs because you basically, it's like just sitting back and watching two extremely funny men do like their one-upmanship on the set in between takes. And I think everybody knew. And Nora Ephron wrote the script, and talk about an iconic writer. So I think everybody knew from the first read-through of that film that it was going to be a classic. You couldn't help but notice that it had all the elements for a star-making film.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great day. I wish I'd had a bigger part.
Yeah. When people think you, when people see that you were on the Titanic, they probably think it's the James Cameron version, but you're actually in a TV movie called The Titanic.
Yes.
Tell people a little bit about the TV movie, which you've been in several of those, what that's like to be in a TV movie.
Well, the Titanic was my
soap opera?
Yeah, the Titanic was my only miniseries. And TV movies and miniseries, they do shoot faster than feature films, but slower than soaps, of course. This Titanic happened to be shot in Vancouver, I think. Yes, Vancouver. And because it was such a long, oddly enough, it was shot around the same time as the James Cameron movie. So nobody realized at the time. We knew that there was another movie being shot with the name Titanic, and what a strange coincidence. We had no idea it was going to be one of the, you know, the top grossing movies of all time. So ours got kind of buried, and in fact, I played a real character who actually drowned, and she had a very sad story and spent most of the miniseries running through the ship, screaming, "Where's my baby?" And so it was so sad and awful, although exciting also to play her. And I got to work with George C. Scott was the captain of the ship. And the love, the pair of lovers were Catherine Zeta-Jones and Peter Gallagher. So, and Eva Marie Saint was in the movie. She was, if you remember her, she was in Exodus and On the Waterfront and North by Northwest. So she was this phenomenally iconic actress. And so anyway, it was filled with, and Tim Curry, who I'm a huge fan of. So just to be around those people was worth the, you know, doing the movie. But I never actually saw it when it was finished because it was in the days before I was adept at taping things, and I missed it when it was on TV. But anyway, so there was that. And all I remember was they kept flying us back and forth and back and forth because they save money if they don't keep you up on the set because they have to pay you for every day you're on location. So they'd rather fly you home. So that's all I remember about that was flying up to Canada and back once or twice a week for about 4 weeks. But I was very happy to have drowned in that because the people who didn't drown had to be on the lifeboats, which was in this very cold tank, like a big swimming pool. Anyway, it was unpleasant to be in those lifeboats. So we who drowned on the ship were actually happier to be dead.
That's funny. As an actress, what type of director do you prefer working with? Somebody who's more hands-on or more kind of laissez-faire?
That's a really good question. You know what? If it's a well-written movie and they loved what you did in the audition, then it's great to be laissez-faire. If it is, if you're in trouble, you pray to have a director who can help you out. Mm-hmm. And I would say, you know, it's interesting because I'm trying to remember. I think, okay, so Parenthood, Ron Howard, who I think is a fantastic director. I've often wondered since, because I saw some of that movie recently, and I thought that is it's a great movie. It's kind of a classic. And how did he get those performances? And I think he when I auditioned, he said that's fantastic. And when I said, you know, like on the set, what do you want? I think he essentially said, just do what you did in the audition. I cast you because, you know, because I liked what you did. So just do that. And I thought, okay. And although it was a very well-written movie as well, I think he's kind of I think maybe the more laissez-faire directors, maybe their imprint goes into the casting process. I think if a movie is well cast, then they can stand back. But I don't know that I've ever worked with someone who's the, as you would say, the auteur theory of directing, who's very hands-on. And Roman Polanski comes to mind just by reputation. I've never actually met him, but I think he's a remarkable director. But apparently he's more hands-on and micromanaging. And I think I've mostly worked with the other kind.
Uh-huh. Have you ever turned down a role for any reason?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Did you ever regret any of the roles that you turned down?
Let me see. There was a movie called The Hand That Rocks the Cradle.
Oh, yeah.
And
great movie.
I didn't turn down the role. I think I may have turned down the audition. Like, I wasn't offered the role, but somewhere in the audition process, I said, no, I don't really want to go in on this. And I remember my best friend was really upset with me because she loved that movie. But too bad. I don't remember, but I think there must have been something else that was in competition with that. Probably the most famous thing that I turned down was at the time that I was auditioning for Parenthood, I also auditioned for a pilot for a TV show. And I went in on the first audition and they said, great, we want to see you again. And they called me in for a callback, and I called my agent and I said, you know what, it's January and this is going to be shooting off the coast of Malibu, and do you have any idea how cold the water is in the Pacific Ocean in January? I can't do it. I just came from doing a TV series in Toronto, and it's the coldest I've ever been, and I can't be cold right now. I just can't do it. And he said, okay, well, I think you're making a mistake. I said, no, it's a stupid pilot, and they didn't even ask me if I could swim, and it's all about lifeguards. And, of course, it turned out to be Baywatch.
Right.
So I did say no to Baywatch, but I did Parenthood instead. So I think it was, for me, the right choice because I would have been miserable in a bathing suit for all those years.
Mm-hmm. What would be your advice to an actor trying to get into the business? What would be the best approach?
I would say get the best training that you possibly can and do as much work as you can, whether you're paid or not, and probably for a long time you won't be paid, and see if you really, 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 really love the process of working, because unless you have a passion for it, you're going to drop out pretty quickly because the business is too difficult and heartbreaking if you don't really love the work for its own sake. And that's it. The tough thing about acting, and one of the reasons that I turned to writing eventually, was that you can't act in a vacuum. You have to wait until somebody says yes to you. And you can't do it on your own in front of your mirror. In fact, working in front of a mirror on your own is really detrimental to your growth as an artist. So don't do that. But it's very difficult and frustrating when you have to wait for the stars to align and a bunch of people to say yes to you in order to practice your craft. So take classes. If you enjoy it, look around. Not all classes are equal. And not all teachers are equal. But if you find somebody that you really click with, just keep working as much as you can, whether you're getting paying work or not.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit about your transition into writing, why you decided to do that, and what your first step was to getting into that.
Writing was something I'd always had a passion for. But it was a secondary passion to my acting. And somewhere in my 30s, I noticed, I was taking a class at Santa Monica Community College with a really wonderful teacher who was a novelist named Jim Crusoe. And I was learning so much from him about creative writing, and we were doing short stories, and he published a few of my pieces in the quarterly that they do at Santa Monica College. And so that was really thrilling. And at the same time, I noticed I would have to keep leaving class because I would get work and I'd go on location, and he'd say, just keep a journal and write about your work on location. And so some of those were the pieces that he published. And I noticed after a while that those, whatever night it was, Tuesday nights, that was the highlight of my week, and that I found myself hoping I wouldn't get work because I didn't want to miss my Tuesday night writing class. And I also noticed that I was so thrilled to be in a place where it didn't matter what I looked like, or, you know, if my complexion was good that week, or my body felt, you know, it didn't none of it mattered. I was judged only by the words on the page and not by how I looked. And that was such a relief after decades of, you know, having such a spotlight on my physical appearance. And at some point, and then I got married, and then I had three babies, like boom, boom, boom. And my first baby, as soon as I found out I was pregnant, I had just shot a pilot and I was supposed to go into production. And I called the costumer. I said, wow, I'm pregnant. I just found out. And she said, oh. And I said, okay, don't tell the producer. Let me call him up right now. Well, he called me about a minute later. She'd obviously told him, like, you know, in the next breath. And he said, I don't know what to do. We can't use you if you're pregnant. And I said, yeah, I understand. Anyway, they paid me to sit home because, you know, we were already – it was a pay-or-play contract. So I could have worked, but they didn't want to shoot around a pregnant stomach, which – I understand artistically. So we parted ways in a very friendly manner. And that was my last TV series. And that was 14 years ago, because that baby is now 13.
Yeah.
So I'm just now thinking about going back, because my three kids are now in middle school. And I'm kind of intrigued by the idea of going back, because I've been away so long. It feels like a really long intermission. And now I'm kind of ready for act two.
Tell us about your series of books.
Oh, yeah. So, So after my class at Santa Monica College, one of those pieces turned into a longer form, and my teacher said, you should go figure out, you know, take a novel writing class. So I went to UCLA Extension, which is my home away from home, the writer's program there, and I took a bunch of classes on how to write a novel. And then after a year or two of writing it, I realized, oh, this isn't women's fiction, it's a murder mystery. So then I took a course in how to write crime fiction and then a course in forensics. And then I sold it, and then I wrote three more in that series. So I wrote a series of murder mysteries about a woman named Wally Shelley, who is a Los Angeles greeting card designer and completely unsuited for solving crime and has no physical courage or special abilities and is a fish out of water in the crime scene world. And I didn't intend for the book to be a series. I thought it was just a one-off, a standalone book. If I had known I was writing a series, I think I would have given her some different characteristics, because it's a little tricky to write a series of books that are murder mysteries about someone who's not only unsuited to be solving crime, but lives in a world that doesn't intersect with crime. So my challenge was, and as you can probably guess, they're lighthearted books, and so that was the saving grace, is that someone picking up this book and attracted to it is not looking for really hardcore crime. I tried to make them as plausible as possible under the circumstances, and they are, so these things could have happened. They're not actually really that plausible, and they're not hard-boiled, but they're pretty funny. They're lighthearted. They're in the style approximately of Janet Ivanovich. She's the writer to whom I'm most often compared, which is a big compliment because she's a great and funny writer.
Now, how did you get that first publisher? What process did you go through to get that?
Well, first of all, I spent 10 years writing the book. So that was that's the thing that makes people cringe, aspiring writers, to hear that I spent 10 years writing my first book. I have to say that that's unusual. Most writers may spend 10 years learning to write books, but they'll write maybe 3 or 4 or 5 unpublishable books before they write the one that gets published. In my case, I would hear writers talk about that, and I thought, I can't do that. I've put too much time into this one. So I just kept rewriting the same book for 10 years until it was publishable. Yeah. And then I found an agent first, and I had gone to the Maui Writers Conference before I was published and became friendly there with an author named Karen Joy Fowler, who's really wonderful, and she kind of became a mentor for me. And she had a friend over the holidays at her house, and her friend picked up my manuscript, which was sitting on Karen's kitchen table, and read it. And that friend sent it to her agent and said, I think you would like this. And that agent became my agent. And so it was like a great piece of good fortune, but it was after me spending about 6 months looking for agents on my own. So it didn't, you know, it wasn't only magical, but it was pretty magical. And then that agent worked with me for about 3 or 4 months, getting it, you know, making the book more to her specifications. And at that point, I gave birth to my twins. And then when my twins were about 3 months old, we sold the book to Doubleday in a 2-book deal. And then after I wrote the second book, they asked for 2 more books. So that's how that happened.
That's great. Great. Yeah. And you recently switched to a different genre. Now you've written a book about the paranormal called Keeper of the Moon. Tell us really quickly about that one.
That was my friend Heather Graham, who the writer, not the actress. She's a very prolific and wonderful writer, and she's a good friend of mine. And she asked me and our friend Alexandra Sokoloff to write a trilogy of books for Harlequin's imprint, their paranormal imprint called Nocturne. And so Alexandra and Heather and I came up with this world of this paranormal world. And Heather's books primarily deal with vampires, Alexandra's deal with shapeshifters, and mine deal with elves. And all the characters intersect. And it's the series is called The Keepers series, and this is The Keepers LA. And it was a really interesting and unusual way to write a book, but it worked very well because we're very good friends, and we see eye to eye on things. And it was so much fun to make up a world. I love fantasy as a reader, and I love sci-fi, and it never occurred to me that I could do this. So I was thrilled to have the opportunity, and it was so much fun, and I think it turned out well.
Mm-hmm. Now, what would be your advice for somebody who's a writer who wants to get into writing and publishing? What would be a good advice for them?
Okay, well, I guess similar to acting, to get as much training as you can. I'm sort of a class-taking junkie. I think it's because my mother was a college professor, but I love taking classes. And so I've taken a lot of classes. But I would say whatever your own method of learning is, whether it's to read great books or to do online courses or show up at your local community college or if you're actually in college, do as much as you can, get as much great feedback from other professionals or other people who are engaged in artistic processes. So, in other words, maybe not your mom, maybe not your husband, unless they are in the field or have an artistic sensibility, because you need to have the best possible manuscript you can have before you send it out to people. Because it's such a competitive and tough industry, you don't want to waste any opportunity. So generally you get one shot with an agent or an editor. So you want to make your book the best it can be before you send it to them, because if they don't like it, you probably won't get a second shot with them, even if a year later it's a better written book. You know, it's that boat has pretty much sailed. Now, that's the landscape for writers has changed too because of the proliferation of online publishing and self-publishing, but you still want to have the best possible manuscript that you can, because even if you do it yourself, you don't want that out there in 5 years if it's not great, because you look back on it and you cringe. I mean, I look back on my first novel, and there's things I think, oh my gosh, if I'd only known then what I know now. Of course, it can't be helped, but the point is, don't rush into publication until you are really, really satisfied that the book is as good as you can make it. And that means getting feedback from other people. Writers' groups, for me, have been invaluable. And classes are invaluable because that's like, you know, those are people that are willing to work with you on your stuff and read it. And I think other eyeballs is a really key concept for everybody, even established writers. They need other people reading their book before they send it to the editor.
Now, how do people find out more about you and your books? Do you have a website or anything that people can check out?
I do have a website. It's www.harleyjanekozak.com. And I am embarrassed to say that I do not keep it up to date as much as I should, but it does have the general information on it. And my next ambition is to, I'm writing a screenplay right now, so all my focus is on that at the moment. But I have to get more savvy about public social media. So I'm kind of waiting for my children to grow up and teach me all about it. To my dismay, my children think that Facebook is just for old people, and the only thing they do is Instagram and Spotify
and Twitter.
So so that's, you know, I can't believe something is already out of style and I never really mastered it. But there you have it.
Well, we're running out of time, but you shared some great things today. Thank you for coming on the show. And, you know, when you get back into acting and are doing something else, you know, or another book, I might bring you back.
Thanks, Rachel. I would love that.
Okay. Thank you, Harley. I'm sure I'll talk to you soon, but thank you for being on the show today.
It was a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Okay, well, that was a great conversation with Harley Jane Kozak, and check out her website, and all her books are available, I believe, on Amazon.com, so you can type in her name and see all of her books. I'm actually reading one of her books right now, which is called A Date You Can't Refuse, but she has a whole series, and like she said, she has her newest series as well, if you're a paranormal fan, and like fantasy rather than mystery. She has that out there, too. And if you've missed any of her films, she's got a ton of films that she's been in. Check out her IMDb.com account. She's been in so many things throughout the years. It's amazing. But, guys, I'm thank you for being on the show or listening to the show today. And I'm back this week, but you might have noticed that my schedule's been a little bit more erratic than usual. But I personally am in a couple of films, so my schedule is altering a little bit. So if you want to know when the next Indie Streak show is, make sure to check out our Facebook account, which is www.facebook.com/IndieStreak. Despite what we just talked about, that Facebook is out of style, to me it's still in style because I still like it. So I have a Facebook account, so check that out. And I always put stuff on my Twitter as well. Rachel Galvin is my Twitter name. And I'm always posting up about the shows that I've done on there as well. So you can always like me on Twitter too. Okay, I wanted to let you know, for those that may not know, that the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival is just around the corner, and I just went to the poster unveiling party. The poster, of course, was photographed by Peter Langone, who always does the poster, and it starred Erica Batchelor, the actress, as the model in the poster. Now, the film festival is going to be taking place October 18th through November 11th is the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival, and there are some great guests this year, including Anna Paquin, who you might know from True Blood, and she was also in The Piano and other things, and Leah Thompson is going to be here from Back to the Future and so many other great movies, Some Kind of Wonderful. Some of my favorite people are coming. I'm very excited. Also, classic actors like Anne Margaret and Tab Hunter will be here. So you can check out all of the schedule of events. There's a lot of films that come to town. There's four different locations this year. There's a location in Hollywood, also the headquarters Cinema Paradiso in Fort Lauderdale. There's Pompano, and there is Sunrise. So no matter where you live in this Broward County area, you can easily check out a film. And there's a lot of people that come from Naples, from West Palm Beach, from Miami to come see films. And, of course, there's people here from all over the world that are showing their films. So if you're an actor, it's a great place to network with filmmakers. And if you're a filmmaker, it's a great place to meet your next crew or your next actors, that type of thing. So it's a wonderful experience to go to the film festival. It's my favorite film festival to attend. And I also like the Palm Beach International Film Festival as well. I go to that one too in April. But it's coming up, guys, and I will be there at as many events as I can possibly be. And I will be interviewing some of the directors for some of the films that will be shown there. So, like I said, stay tuned to the show and see who's coming up next. I may have some bonus shows, or I may be fluctuating, changing some things up here in the next month or so, where I have some shows on different days rather than Sunday, just to accommodate my busy schedule, because I will be attending the events as well as rehearsing and filming two different movies. So it's a busy time for me. And but I will try to keep as many films as possible so that you guys have content to listen to. And in the meantime, you can always go back and listen to the archives, because I have about 80 shows that I've done throughout since January 2012 that you can listen to. And I've had some great guests on with some really great information, like Harley today, some wonderful information for actors, etc. So also, guys, if you're a filmmaker out there, or I mostly take filmmakers. Harley was a little bit of an anomaly, a little different than normal, but definitely well worth it. But if you're a filmmaker and you'd like to be on the show, please email me at ravenprods@yahoo.com. That's Raven, like the bird, prods, like productions, at yahoo.com. And I would be happy to look at your information and see if I can bring you on the show. Okay, guys, I'm running out of time. I thank you for listening to the show today. And I will not be here next Sunday. But like I said, check out my Facebook and see when I will be coming back next. So probably be the following Sunday. Okay? Thank you, guys. Bye-bye.